Okay. Well, first, we'd like to convene the regular meeting and then recess the supplemental meeting. Okay. And then now we'd like to have a moment of silence. Thanks. Now I'd like to move to the consent agenda. The first thing would be the approval of the November 12th, both public meeting and regular meeting minutes. Do people have a chance to review that? Are there any questions or comments? Okay. Assuming no comments, can we have a motion to approve the minutes?
Armando, motion to approve.
Okay, and that would be for both. And who second?
Tina.
Okay. And that would be both for the public meeting and the require in the regular meeting. And all in favor? Say aye.
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 Any
aye.
Any opposed? Okay, it's approved. Next we have the consent agenda. Kelly, is there anything there you want to flag?
No, there's nothing unusual on this month's consent agenda. Thank you.
Okay. So can I have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved. Bill.
Okay.
Bill. Second. Alan, second.
Okay. Any comments? All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion passes. All right. So now we'll go to item D1. Okay. Do we have anyone in the public world that would like to say anything or make any comments?
If they'll press 5-star, it'll raise their hand and I'll unmute them.
All right.
I'm not saying
anything. Nothing.
No.
Okay. All right, let's move on to item C1.
Okay, I believe that's the report on the audit committee meeting. Nick, the committee, which is made up of Tina, Armando, and myself, met with BDO on Tuesday afternoon. Good meeting. Highlights of that meeting, and I'm only going to hit the highlights because Rachel Pearson from BDO is going to give a summary report of what they reported to the audit committee. But it was the best news we could get. I mean, the financial audit was clean as a whistle. There were no internal control comments. There were no adjustments to the financial statements. They were very complimentary of staff, being ahead of the process as much as possible, despite the delay with the Huff report. Remember, these are the December 2019 reports that you're going to be reporting on at this point and we'll be approving. We did spend a little bit of time on, you know, the evaluation process for Huff and Lone Star and, you know, they're using very consistent approaches and I think we got satisfied given how old these financials are. That was the information, the best information they had at the time. And the only thing is that after we approve it today, then Kelly and Brenda will need to sign the rep letters to finalize it. But overall, it sounds like despite the virtual nature, both the audit team at BDO and staff did an excellent job this year bringing this to an end. Tina or Armando, do you want to add anything?
No, sir. That was a great summary.
Yes, and I think they really highlighted the point, and Jill can elaborate later. Oh, I'm sorry, Rachel?
Yep.
Okay. But, yes, it gets a little bit confusing because it's still at the end of the year. You tend to want to talk about 2020 issues, but you have to kind of keep that in the back of your head and just clean it at 2019. So I suggest that when you hear that report as well.
John, we're getting some echo. Is there any advice you have to that people to?
If you're not actually talking, please mute your phone. I can mute you for you, but then you'd have to press the star to get unmuted. Nick, before we move on to the next item, I did have one request to speak.
Sure.
I'm going to unmute phone number ending in 2617.
Okay, so would the person on that line identify themselves before they have expressed their comment or view?
Good morning. This is Jerry Rhodes, and I haven't been on the board here lately, staying up with you guys, but reading your reports and stuff. And I just wanted to say thank you and happy holidays to everybody. And we, as I speak for myself as a pensioner, I appreciate everything you do and helping us, and my family appreciates it as well. So Merry Christmas and happy holidays to all of you, and we appreciate your support, and we look forward to a little bit better 2021.
Thanks, Jerry. Those are kind words and thoughts. We appreciate it. John, anything else?
No, that was the only one.
Okay. So I think now we're going to move to item C2, which is the financial audit, and we have Rachel from BDO, who I believe is on the line, and Rachel, go ahead and talk through it with us.
Okay, thanks. Yes, good morning, everyone. As mentioned, we already had our meeting with the audit committee, so I'll be going through this document at a very high level just to summarize some key points. If you want to go ahead and move a couple of pages to our status of our audit. Yep, thank you. So our audit is now complete, and we will be issuing an unmodified opinion. Management cooperation was excellent throughout the audit, and we will be able to release the final audit report today once we get the signed presentation letter, which I believe we'll be receiving today as well. If you want to move to the next slide. So this just overall gives a summary of accounting practices and policies that have remained unchanged and are included in Note 2 of the financial statement. And then we also list on this page estimates that we consider to be significant. There were no significant changes to the processes or assumptions used to develop those significant estimates. And at the bottom there, we note no corrected or uncorrected misstatements identified during the audit. So on the next page, this does start summarizing our overall key procedures for certain areas and goes from our focus on internal controls, the actuarial evaluation process, and our procedures around that. And then the next slide goes on to highlight key procedures we performed over eligibility and benefit payment testing. And then at the bottom there is a summary of procedures we do around investments. And then the next slide continues on to summarize procedures over the other receivables and payables that are on the statement of fiduciary net position, our procedures over investment income, and then other procedures over review of legal expenses, journal testing, and subsequent events, with considerations there regarding the potential impact of COVID-19, which was a sub-event since we were speaking to the 12/31/19 financials. And just ensuring overall appropriate disclosures are included in the financial statements regarding potential subsequent impacts. If you want to go to the next slide, that speaks again to our sub-event procedures. And then the next slide is just a summary of internal controls over financial reporting and defines what a deficiency is, a significant deficiency, and then a material weakness. And then we can report that we did not identify any material weaknesses. And then the next slide just has some other required communications. We do utilize a specialist throughout the audit, such as our actuarial group and valuation specialists. We are not aware of any consultations with other accountants, and there were no disagreements with management or significant difficulties encountered during the audit. And then the last slide just confirms our independence of the system. So that's just a high-level overview of our wrap-up book. We went through it, of course, in more detail with the audit committee, but if there's any questions, just, you know.
Can you guys still hear me?
I can hear.
Yeah. This is Nick. I just want to express to both Jill and Rachel appreciation, to you two and the entire BDO team. You guys are excellent business partners, and we appreciate working with you guys and appreciate this year's end product. So thank you very much. Any comments or questions from anyone about the audit? Okay. All right. So what we'd like to do is to have a motion to approve the issuance of the 2019 audit report subject to final review and approval by BDO and the executive director.
As chair of the audit committee, I'll motion.
Okay. Brenda, were you going to talk about this is Kelly. Brenda, were you going to talk about the actual results of the audit? Rachel talked about kind of the process and the results, but were you going to cover the financial results in the...
Yeah, I was going to go right to that next, Kelly.
Okay.
Kelly, I was going to go right to that next.
Okay, thank you.
I'll move approval of the audit.
You have a second?
Alan.
I'll second Nick. Gilbert.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion carries. Now we'd like to move to Brenda to talk about the whole comprehensive annual financial report, of which what we just approved is a subset of it. So go ahead, Brenda.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning, everyone. Pleased to be here this morning and talk about our CAFR. As Nick alluded to, the audited financial statements are embedded inside the CAFR. And so as I go through the CAFR, we'll talk about some very specific things in those statements. What I'd like to do, for those of you who haven't seen our CAFR before or maybe are wondering what is a CAFR, I'm going to just be reviewing some highlights and letting you know that this will be posted on the website when it's completed, when we finalize it, and that there are already prior years posted on the website, from 2014 forward. So if you haven't seen a CAFR before, you may be wondering, what is a CAFR? Well, a CAFR is just our comprehensive annual financial report. It's a thorough, detailed presentation of the pension system's financial condition. It reports on the pension's activities and the balances for each fiscal year. So, John, if you'll go to page one. So, back a couple of pages. I'll be using the page numbers on the bottom. There you go. This table of contents, I just wanted to share. These are the sections of the CAFR. You have an introduction. You have a financial section. And, again, that financial section is our audited financials that are embedded within the CAFR. You have investment information, actuarial, and statistical. And we'll go through those shortly. So if you'll go to the next page, Dawn. There we go. So we start with the transmittal letter. Kelly prepares this. And just go a couple more pages, John. It just goes through information about DPFP, initiative, financial results, and she talks about the year. Go to the page 8, please. So you'll see a small section on the Board of Trustees, and then the next page, there's all of your smiling faces for all of our members to see. And then one more page, you'll see the two additions to the board that have been made during 2020. And then the next page is our administrative organization. So, again, introduction, talks about the system, the board, and our administrative. John, let's now move into the financial section and go to page 18. First few pages in the financial section are the letters from BDO. Here's where I always like to start, the combining statements of fiduciary net position. You see 3 years of history here. When you compare 2019 to 2018, you will see that our net position increased by $15 million in 2019, and that's primarily the result of investment gains and contribution increases exceeding the increase in benefit payments during the year. So we'll go to the next page. Here is the changes in our fiduciary net position. And just to highlight a couple of items from here, city contributions to the plan increased by $5.9 million or 3.9% in 2019. And that's due to an increase in the biweekly floor amount. Member contributions in 2019 were $52.4 million, and they exceeded 2018 contributions by $3 million because of increased salaries and an increase in our member count. Now, John, if we'll go to page 21. Benefits paid to our members increased by $12.9 million or 4.3% over 2018, and that's primarily due to additional retirees and beneficiaries. And as you look at this chart, you can see by far the largest amount of our benefit payments are just in our regular monthly benefit payments. That's the gray bar. The red bar is the drop annuity payment. And then the little blue bar is just other drop payments of grandfather's hardships. You can see that our benefit payments did increase during 2019. Now if you'll go to page 24. So this is, again, the same combining statements of fiduciary net position, but in this format, broken down between the combined pension plan and the supplemental pension plan. And you'll see throughout the CAFR, information presented in different ways, sometimes consolidated, and we'll refer to it as the consolidated plan, split up amongst the plans, the combined plan, and the supplemental plan. So this is a format where we're showing the two plans independently. And if we go to the next page, this is the changes in fiduciary net position, but again, showing that breakdown between the combined and the supplemental pension plan. If you'll go to page 26, John. Here we start into the notes to the statement. As you'll see, if you look at the chart at the bottom, total active members in 2019 were 5,121, and in 2018 they were 5,012, and that's an increase in membership of active members of 109 over 2018. As we go to the next page, and over the next two or three pages, you'll see descriptions of the benefits, how the benefits are calculated, how they're earned. So go through 27 through 30 here are just descriptions for the combined plan, the supplemental plan that you'll see. So if we'll move now, John, to page 36.
I'm sorry, what page was that?
36. So page 36 shows the fair value of our investment, again, comparing to 2018. And it is by the asset classes. So you see fixed income, equity, real assets, private equity, but a little more detail than you would see in our normal financial statement. So under fixed income, you see a breakdown of treasury versus municipal bonds versus corporate bonds or equity securities split by domestic and foreign. So a little more detail, but still that comparative between this year and last year. And if you'll go to 38, so here's information about our fixed income securities, and it adds information about the maturities of those. So again, a little more detail in how much is held in treasury bonds and government agencies and what are their maturities. Less than 1 year, 1 to 5, 6 to 10, and more than 10. And you'll see 2019 and 2018. The next page, John, let's go to page 44. So this table here shows the investments by type, by our fair value hierarchy. Are they level 1, 2, and 3? We have the table for 2019. There's also one for 2018. So it shows you where the investments fall in that fair value hierarchy and then those investments that are measured at NAV. And if you'll go to the next page, John, you'll see again the same thing, but this shows 2018. If we move to page 47, now we're looking at the net pension liability. Again, this is an example of where we're breaking it down between the combined pension and the supplemental pension. And doing year-over-year comparison. If we move to page 48, this starts listing the actuarial assumptions. And last month when Siegel presented the actuarial report, you would have seen these same assumptions in the valuation. Showing these are the assumptions that were used for the actuarial valuation. So these start on page 48. Now if we'll move to page 52 is where we start presenting information about the deferred retirement option plan or DROP. And now to 53, John. So the charts here on 53, or the tables here on 53, they present information about the present value of the annuities and the number of participants. Again, you're looking at the combined and the supplemental information split apart, and then just rolling through those changes showing 2018 and 2019. So let's go ahead and move to page 58. This is the beginning of the required supplementary information in the audited financials, which are in the CAFR. This schedule lists 6 years of information. It will eventually list 10 years as we have 10 years of comparative information. Again, it's broken down on page 58. This is the combined pension plan. This chart is really good for trending information, and you can see long periods of time as you're comparing the same information. As we go to page 59, this is the same chart, but it is for a table, but this one is for the supplemental pension plan. On page 60, this is where we start looking at all of the changes in the benefit terms. So you'll see as of 2019 and 18, there were no changes in benefit terms. But in 2017, there were, because of HB 3158, significant changes. And we list what those changes are in case there's anyone who has questions about those. And if we go to page 61, this is where we talk about the changes of methods and assumptions. And again, we're listing any changes over each of the 6 years that we have information presented for on those tables. So that's 61 through 63. You'll see all of those changes. If you'll move to page 64. This is the schedule of employer contributions. This information is on the combined pension plan. We have the 4 years presented for this schedule. It is intended to show 10, and we will have more years as they become available. Prior to 2016, the actuarial determined contribution for the combined plan was not determined by the actuary, so we couldn't present it in this table. But here, you have trending information, and you have notes about the methods and assumptions that are used. And if we go to page 67, same information, but now you're looking at information for the supplemental plan. And the last schedule in the financial section is page 71. And this details out the administrative, investment, and professional services expenses. Again, in a little more detail than you would normally see in a quarterly financial presentation, showing the different types of expenses that fall into these categories, and a little more detail there. And this is the end of the financial section. So let's go ahead and let's move into, and so this would be what you've seen in the financial section is the audited financials. So now let's move to the investment section and go to page 73. So the investment section starts with an investment memo from Makita. So you have a couple of pages where they are talking about the system. And as we move to page 77, this is the investment table. It's by asset class against benchmark and over several time periods. So you have the equity, again, fixed income, but then you'll see, like under equity, you can see Boston Partners and the benchmark against that. You can see the percentage of the portfolio, the 2019 return, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. So it's giving you a lot of comparative information. So that starts on 77 and goes through page 78. If you'll go to 78, John, you'll see the end of that table. And then let's move to page 79. So 79 and 80 detail out the goals, the objectives, the investment policy. If we'll go to page 80, you'll also see information about the asset allocation table. This should look familiar to everyone. As we go to page 81, you'll see the asset allocation implementation plan. And as we go to page 84, this is where we have information about management fees. This is also where we were putting together information for the new SB 322, but you'll see information about the management fees by asset class and how they were paid. And as we roll on to page 85, you'll see other investment expenses, the brokerage fees, and commissions. And then on page 86, this is our largest public equity and fixed income holding, so that you can see those largest dollars for those two categories. Largest holdings there. And finally, on page 87, this is a list of our investment managers. So that's the type of information that you see in the investment section of the CAFR. As we go on and we look at the actuarial section, if you'll go to page 89, again, it starts with a letter from Siegel. And detail some information about the actuarial valuation. Pardon me. If we'll move to page 93. Here's where we start information on the funding. And as Siegel spoke to us last month, the combined pension funded ratio declined to 45.7% as of January 1st, 2020. That's from a 48.1%, pardon me, as of January 1st, 2019. And that's due to changes in assumptions with the experience study and the return assumptions that were made this year. If we move on to pages 94 and 95, you'll see again these actuarial assumptions and methods. As we move to page 100, this is the analysis of the financial experience, and it is a gain-loss analysis of changes in the actuarial liability or the unfunded accrued liability, and it shows how that is developed and the components of that calculation. As we go to pages 103 and 104, here's where you have some member information. You're getting 10 years of trending information, number of members. Again, this is broken down by the combined and the supplemental plan. Number of members, covered payroll, average covered payroll, an average pay there, and then on the next page as well, 104, additional member information. And then as we go to page 105, you'll find the funding progress, again broken down by the two plans, which shows 10 years of information of the actuarial value of the assets, the actuarial accrued liability, the percentage, unfunded, annual covered payroll, and you'll see that for both of the plans. So as we move to the final section of the CAFR, which is the statistical section, and if you'll go to page 107, So in the statistical section, it just provides additional historical perspective, context, and detail with 10-year schedules for the plan. Here you'll see the information is presented in a consolidated format for both plans. And you'll also see some description of the schedules that you're going to see in this section. So let's go ahead and go to pages 109. So again, this is the changes in the fiduciary net position. We've seen them in a couple of different formats. Here is both plans together, so it's consolidated, and you have 10-year trending information for the fiduciary net position. And if we go to the next page, we're moving now to distributions by type. Again, this page has the combined plan on it, showing the type of distributions that were made. Were they service retirement, beneficiaries, disability, drop distributions, or refunds? See it both in the chart format and then the same information in the table format. Obviously, the big bar represents the significant drop distributions that were done. If we go to the next page, same information, but now you're looking at the supplemental plan. And page 113. And this is for both plans, consolidated plans, and it details the benefit recipients by type and the benefit range. So looking at just the first category, 0 to 500, there's 90 benefits broken down by service retirement, disabilities, beneficiaries, non-active, and so it'll show you what's the monthly benefit range, how many folks fall within that range over the various categories of recipients. Page 116, this is the value of the assets versus funded ratio, 10 years of information. This is the combined plan here, shown in both chart form and in table form. So that you can see the actuarial value of assets, market value, the funded ratio, and then the market funded ratio. And page 117 shows the same information for the supplemental plan. And our last chart here on 118 shows some additional membership count information. How many folks are members are in active drop, retirees, beneficiaries, and it's showing the information for both the combined and supplemental plan. So I hope what I've done this morning is just kind of whet your appetite so that you can see the information that is contained in the CAFR, know that it is out there on the website, certainly a resource, as well as the staff, if you have any questions about the CAFR. Does anyone have any questions about the 2019 CAFR?
And Brenda, are you going to send out a hard copy to each of the trustees?
We will. We'll send it to the printer next week, and then so it'll probably be a couple of weeks, and we'll have a hard copy in everyone's hand.
Great. Thank you.
I would just add to all the trustees that in my couple years of being on the board, I take this with me everywhere I go for any pension meeting, and it's my go-to reference guide. So pretty much all the information I'd ever want to reference, say, for instance, I wanted to see what the investment return estimates are for go-forward years or, you know, what the unfunded liabilities are or anything like that, it is my go-to reference guide. So it's just been a very, very helpful tool to me, and it's great to see that staff put together another excellent product for the 2019 year. So If there's no other questions, I'd like to put forward a motion to authorize the executive director to issue the 2019 comprehensive annual financial report upon its finalization. So can I have a first for that, please?
It's Tina first.
Yeah,
I'll motion.
Ken, so
all right, Tina made the first. Is there a second?
I'll second. It's Gilbert.
Gilbert. All right. Any discussion or comment on it? Okay. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion carries. The next item is the 2021 board calendar. If we can put that up, please. And I think we're just following the same protocol that we've had for this past year. Does anyone have any different view or anything they want to discuss relative to this?
This is Kelly. The only thing I'd like to point out is the required public meeting, which we are supposed to have twice a year. We right now have that slotted into November, but if we have the actuarial evaluation done earlier than November, then that meeting will be moved to whatever meeting we have the evaluation available. And also, there's a more detailed calendar of what we anticipate to be on each of these meetings that's in your resource center. It changes a lot, but if you have travel plans or something like that and you want to see what we're tentatively slotting into each of the months, it is out there in the resource center.
And just for the newer members, we did try some afternoon meetings I think a year and a half ago, and I think the consensus was after trying those that the best was just to stick with the 8:30. And Kelly, any view of when you think we might be back in person with these meetings?
I have no idea. Maybe after everybody gets a vaccination, or hopefully when a lot of people are vaccinated. I have no idea at this point.
Okay, so we should just think that be for the intermediate future, still the same format of a online meeting.
Hey, Nick?
Yeah.
This is Gilbert. As a courtesy, when we think we might come in person, you know, please give as much visibility as possible so we can all plan our schedules and so I can plan travel.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Okay. I would see that it being, you know, an anticipated in-person meeting with, you know, still needing to sort of confirm it, whatever month forward that is. So I for
Thank
sure,
you.
There'll be lots of heads up on that.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, the next item is Kelly is going to discuss a communication plan and, I guess, an outside vendor associated with that.
Right. Thank you, Nick. There is a discussion sheet in the agenda, which is at page 239. I don't have any attached materials because I just wanted to talk through this and get some direction from the board. At the last board meeting when we were talking about the actuarial evaluation and the funding of the plan, the board directed me to come up with a communication plan. And what I did was I reached out to Fleshman Hilliard, who is the firm that we used in 2016 and 2017. When we were having the run on the bank crisis and all the plan changes, and talked to them about our needs. They, I think they are the right group to use because we actually spent a long time with them getting them to understand not only defined benefit plans and why they're important, but also all the issues related to DPFP with the drop and the assets and the issue with the city, and they were with us through all of the plan changes and the legislative changes, so they're very familiar with DPFP, so they seem like the right group to use for this. They put together kind of a scope of work or assessment plan. Their plan was very encompassing, and it was really an idea of kind of a jumping-off discussion document just to kind of start the ball rolling. And when I received that, I realized I wasn't clear on what the goal of this communication plan is from the trustees, who the audience is and what the goal is. They had a, you know, all-encompassing five-year plan that including polling of the citizens and trying to change the attitude about kind of public safety in the community, which I don't believe is the goal here. I believe the goal is, you know, the end result is we want to improve the financial position of the pension fund, which is going to require securing additional funding from the city, and hopefully we can do that before 2024 when we get into that legislative mandated review process. But I wanted to confirm that's the goal of the plan and also find out from you if there are other things we're trying to accomplish, such as educating the members about the plan, about the fact that 2017 was really a bridge. Do we want to talk about what we've accomplished since 2017, kind of where we are now, the past, the future, who the audience is? So I have a lot of questions on those types of things that I think would be helpful for me to move forward with a plan. So any input on what you're looking for here and what you'd like to see would be very helpful. So any ideas on what we're trying to accomplish and really who the audience is we're focused on? Is it the members? Is it the city council, which is probably the group that needs to be focused on if we're looking for coming up with an agreement with the city prior to the legislation? Is it the citizens? Is it the legislature? Are there any thoughts on that?
Let me tell you what, I talked to Kelly and I said, I think what we're trying to communicate is the status of the plan, the improvements we've made, why in the next couple of years things will get worse instead of better, that what we did in 2017 was the Band-Aid to stop the hemorrhaging, but we still got other needs like additional funding, and we got to educate the public, the city, the mayor, the city council, the legislature who will be acting on it, the PRB, and making sure they understand that, you know, the problem is not fixed and it needs taking action sooner than later. So, I mean, that was sort of the gist of what I talked to Kelly about.
Yeah, Bill, I agree with everything you just stated. And I think it could be, I think the plan could be multifaceted, so to speak. We can have different target groups. Obviously, our membership is one of those groups, right? Council is another group, and then the general public. We also need to focus on the state legislatures, but I think we need to prioritize those, obviously with the session coming up in 2021, and then with some of the significant changes that we've made over the last few months, I think we need to, you know, have a plan that's going to address the legislators and also our members. I think a lot of people have put it to the back of their mind again, like they did before, and we need to bring it to the forefront because the last thing we want is to be accused of being asleep at the wheel, so to speak. So I'd be happy to help with whatever I can help with, especially from the member standpoint. But I think you've hit the nail on the head. It needs to be different groups that we're targeting, and we need to be communicating with them.
Yeah, this is Mark Nava. I kind of reached out to Bill, and I know he'd already been thinking about it, about this process by which we kind of, it's in addition to education, it's kind of setting a narrative, and I think that's going to be very important to make sure that all the constituencies and all those people that may have a different view of the pension fund, if you don't set the narrative, someone else will.
That makes sense. The cost gets so It gets very expensive if you're trying to start with the general public, I would say. I mean, if you want to just determine where the general public is, the citizens are right now, and you do polling or focus groups to determine that, to kind of set your plan going forward, that gets very expensive very fast. I do think knowing that is important to set the narrative, and that's really kind of my question on really that piece, the focusing on the citizens. Not that the citizens aren't important, they're just a very expensive group to try to communicate with. And I didn't know if our initial focus needed to be more narrow with the members and the city council itself.
Yeah, Kelly, this is Mark. I'll just give you my kind of viewpoint on it. One, we have to, as you, I think, are alluding, we need to be very, very good stewards of whatever funds we're using. At least my personal view in terms of the public, it probably wasn't as extensive as that. It was probably more of a press in terms of getting getting the story out. That could be letters to the editor, that could be press releases, things like that, as opposed to kind of a more kind of data-driven, how do we move a citizenry.
Yeah, I think it would be premature to try to do the public now. You got to get the city on board and maybe the legislature before we can even ask for a vote. So, but I do think planning stories in the Dallas Morning News or D Magazine about the progress we've made and where we're going does start that process.
Okay. And maybe what we can do to try to lessen some of that cost is, you know, the PR firms all like to figure out, you know, where is everybody today? Because you want your messaging to start with where they are today and move them to the next step. So that's what the polling is about, is to figure out where they are. But I think perhaps, obviously not scientific, but with your input, since you're all out in the community in different areas of the walks of life, you know, maybe we can get some sense of where you think everybody is. Because, you know, if we do a campaign of letters to the editor or whatever we do, and we're kind of behind where the citizens are, it doesn't have the impact, or ahead of where they are, it doesn't have the impact. So that's the kind of the reason for the polling. But I personally don't think we should do polling, and don't think we should do focus groups for the citizens, and would like maybe to, when we come back in January with this, get your input on kind of where you think the public is, so we can hit that at the appropriate level.
Yeah, Kelly, I agree with that, and definitely would like to hear kind of your views on this, since you are closer to the ground in some ways than the board is. I know this is a very peculiar issue. Obviously, everyone deeply respects, you know, our first responders, our firemen, our policemen. You know, obviously, the last year or so, you know, there is a balance that we'll need to take to make sure we put our the people we try to serve, firemen and police officers, in the best possible light in a situation in a current environment where I think there are opportunities to do that, but also being very tactical and strategic in how we frame it.
Hey, Kelly, this is Ken. Back in 2017, you know, Tristan Hallman was doing some reports for the morning news for us, and now he works for the mayor's office. I thought he did a fairly good assessment of everything that was going on back then. Is there any way we could reach out to him to possibly talk to him about who he passed the torch to in reporting our system?
Yes, I can reach out to him, and I have been in contact with his replacement. They don't have as much staff as they used to have at the Dallas Morning News, so his replacement focuses on a lot of different areas, but I know they're always looking for stories. So if we were to provide them a story, you know, everybody's appreciative of that. The TV news as well as the newspapers, they're always looking for someone to help them get content out there. So we could do that, and we'd be able to get the contacts either through Tristan or through who we deal with now. And Fleshman has contacts as well.
Okay, good.
My only reservation with using Tristan is that now he works for the mayor's office, so he has a vested interest in making sure those stories get vetted and make sure that it doesn't, you know. So I do think that, you know, I like Tristan a lot. I do trust him, but I just want to be mindful of his interest.
This is Josh. One other thing I would say that I think will be helpful in this process based on what you all are saying is in January, Hilco is going to come in and give you guys an overview, and I think they're obviously, since they're our legislative consultants, they'll be helpful in discussing this issue and how to deal with the legislature and how we sort of approach that piece of it as well and give you all advice on it. When and how and what to say, that type of thing.
Well, given that, Josh, should they be coming in earlier than April? Should we have them more like, if Kelly's going to talk back to us in January and the firm gets back to us in March, I mean, I guess, I don't know, does a March meeting make sense, or what do you think?
No, they're coming in January. I'm sorry, my voice wasn't clear. They're coming in January.
Okay.
Yeah, so they'll be here next month.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And we can have the representative from Fleshman here at the same time, and hearing what Hilco has to say, I think, will be helpful. Okay, is there anything else you'd like me to know? Or if you think of anything over the next few weeks, let me know, and I'll continue to work with them on slimming down their plan. I don't want a 5-year plan. I want, ideally, it would be nice to get this done before in 2023, and not have to go to the 2025 legislative session or be in a fight in 2024. So I'm going to try to focus this in a shorter period and a little more focus to try to make sure it's just not a whole bunch of, you know, not very deep scattershot. That's what I'm trying to avoid. So any thoughts you have over the next couple of weeks, you know, please give me a call. But this is helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, we need to get it done during 21-22, so there's the plan to go to the legislature in 23 with whatever we want. So I think that's what we need to be shooting for.
Right, or ideally we can work out something with the city where we wouldn't need to go to the legislature.
Well, any change in things are probably going to – it's either that or we're going to need a citizen vote on a POB. So, I mean, I just think we need to try to get it wrapped up in 22 so that we can either go to the legislature or go for an election in 23.
I agree. Thank you.
Okay, Kelly, you're going to now go to the monthly contribution report.
Yes, thank you. John, if you can go to page, you're there. Thank you very much. I have notes on three different screens here, so let me get to the right screen. Okay, yes, so this begins on 241. This is the December 2020 report. It's based on October 2020 data. There were two pay periods in October that began in the month, so that's what you're seeing reporting here. The actual number of members on the last payroll in October was 89, more than the estimate. Fire was over by 32 members, and police was under by 121. It's pretty consistent, a little lower than the prior month. On the next page, 242, John, it shows the two charts. The top chart is the city contributions, and the bottom chart is the employee contributions. And you can see we're still on a very good path here with the city contributions. For the month of October, contributions based on comp pay were 109% of the hiring plan estimate and 100% of the floor. Since the inception, contributions have been 100% of the hiring plan and 92% of the floor. So that's good. We made up a lot of that ground that we kind of lost early on. The bottom chart shows the employee contributions, which are in line with the hiring plan. So everything looks good here. Are there any questions about the contribution report? Okay, if no questions there, the next item, Nick, if it's okay with you, I will go to page 246, which is the Trustee Education and Travel Report. This report on the next page, 247, shows some classes from NCPRS and TexPRS that are listed here. The NCPRS classes are virtual. They are in February and March. If you're interested in attending any of those, you can either let us know right now and the board can vote on it, or let us know and we'll put them on the agenda for the next month. The TexPRS classes are in March and August. Right now, those are slated to be in person, and hopefully that will happen. But again, if you're interested in any of that, let us know.
Hey, Kelly, this is Ken. I would be interested in going to the TexPRS conference in March, if they have one, which I doubt very seriously they will.
Okay. They probably will have one. Maybe it'll be virtual. But with that, since you're interested in doing that, can we get a board motion to approve Ken to go to the March TexPRS annual conference?
I'll make the motion.
I'll move
next.
It. I'll second. Gilbert.
All in favor? Aye. Any
aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
The motion
aye.
Carries.
Great. Thank you. And Ken, I'll have Carol send you the form on that so she can get that going for you.
She already has.
Oh, well, there you go.
Okay. Yeah. I've already started the process, so thanks.
Thank you very much. That's all I have on that item.
Okay. I'll report in next. I took over, I guess, from Bill as the chair of the professional services provider meetings, the PSPM, as we refer to it on the inside. And we had our first meeting recently in the last week or so. The other members of the trustees are Alan, Steve, Mark, and Robert. And we sat down or talked virtually with both Jeff and Caitlin at Siegel, and then Chuck Campbell and Jackson Walker, two separate calls, so one was not on the other call. And, you know, in both cases, you know, the report is that they raised no, you know, issues that they would want to bring to our attention. We talked a lot with both about the forward path and, you know, the likely need that we'll need to address, you know, external additional funding sources and things like that, and really just sort of discussed their roles as business partners and how they would be part of that solution, you know, in the process for identifying alternatives and a solution. And, you know, both groups said, you know, they understand that. They're up for the task. And, you know, they were very complimentary of staff and gave us assurances that they would be, you know, solid business partners going forward. So that's about it. And I would ask if any of the other members have any additional comments they'd like to make.
No, there's not much for me to add. This is Steve, everybody. Not for me to add to what Nick just said, but just to reiterate, we just really encourage them to share their opinions with us, knowing what we're going to be going into, and to avoid any surprises, and to be sure that we're doing our best to control the soundbite with the public and the different constituents we'll need to engage to protect the fund. And we really encourage them for us to do that with as much visibility as possible.
Okay. All right. So moving on, the next item is Kelly and Josh talking about, you know, the staff retirement plan. I would just say in particular, I would be interested in you know, views and feedback from the non-mayoral appointees on this issue, those who are, in discussions with the associations on a more frequent basis, and what their views are on this issue and just how the perception side of it and those sorts of things, kind of, you know, after Kelly and Josh make their comments.
Thanks, Nick. Just as a way of background for some of the newer members on the board, the DPFP staff has currently 24 employees, and we do not participate in Social Security, and we're not members of the pension plan that we administer. What the retirement plan is for the members of DPFP is a defined contribution plan, and in that defined contribution plan, the employee puts in 6.5% and the system puts in 12%. When the employee retires, they have whatever they have. So hopefully they've invested well and, you know, it all works out. But they don't have a lifetime guarantee like Social Security or something else. And, you know, especially given the fact that, we're in the business of providing retirement, these employees probably have some of the least secure retirement of many employees in the state just because they don't have any lifetime guarantee of a benefit, no Social Security, if they work at the pension system for their whole career. So we have been looking for, gosh, a year and a half or 2 years on a way to solve this issue. We've looked at a variety of options, and I know years ago, there was some plan amendment where they were trying to get the staff into the DPFP plan, and the members turned that down. So that, even if we could do that, it would require legislation, but the members, would not be supportive of that. So we didn't explore that option any further. We did look at doing a small defined benefit plan for just the DPFP staff, like Fort Worth has a staff plan. We ran into problems with that because we are such a small plan. We don't have any place to put the assets to be invested. We don't want to put them into the main plan, and they're just too small that none of the other funds out there, Vanguard or Voya or anybody, wanted to deal with that. So we didn't have any place to really cost-effectively or practically put the assets to be invested. We looked at getting into the Dallas Employees Pension Plan. That's where the Dallas Employees Retirement Staff is. But we cannot get into the Dallas Employees Plan because we're not city employees. So to do that, we would either need to become city employees, which I don't even know what that would entail, or we would need to change the Dallas employee plan, which would require a vote of the citizens. So that was kind of a dead end also. At the time we thought about the Texas Municipal Retirement System, which is a statewide cash balance plan for cities that participate in the plan. It's a multi-employer plan. And we don't fit the definition to be in that plan either. But we've looked at that further and believe with a one- or two-sentence legislative change, we could basically ride ourselves into that plan and allow members to participate. And so we reached out to both HILCO and to TMRS to see if they think that would be possible. And HILCO thinks it's possible and could even, you know, go through kind of a uncontested local agenda without much trouble. TMRS, we reached out to them, and their staff and their board is supportive of the idea. They talked about it at their board meeting last Thursday, and they're supportive of the idea. So that's helpful as well. The way that plan would work, it's a cash balance plan, which means the employer contributions go in. There's a guaranteed interest amount, And then when the employee retires, that gets converted to a lifetime annuity for their life expectancy and any survivor benefits they choose. So that does provide the goal that we're trying to seek here. So what this item is to just to get your approval to continue forward and seek the legislative change to allow the DPFP staff to get into the TMRS plan. And the way TMRS works is the systems get to select from a kind of a slate of options on the employee and employer contribution amounts. So that would determine how much people put in. And right now the options, I believe, are the employee could put in 5, 6, or 7%, and they're currently putting in 6.5%. So we would have to pick either 6 or 7. And this is a decision that doesn't need to be made until, next September when we would get into the plan if we could pass the election. And then the system either pays one times what the employee puts in, 1.5 or 2 times. So that would mean basically if you did 2 times, you would put in 12, which is what you're doing now, if the employees were putting in 6, or 14 if the employees are putting in 7. So that's the decision point that would need to be made down the road. So that is the current thinking. Are there questions about that or concerns?
Yes, ma'am. I have a couple questions. It's Armando. So you're telling me that that it's basically a cost-neutral event if we were to switch you guys over from or start you in TMRS. It wouldn't cost the DPFP any money?
So it wouldn't if you pick, if the employees are putting in 6 and the employer is putting in 12, because right now you're putting in 12. But that would mean the employees putting in 0.5% less than they currently are. So it's really a decision for the board if they wanted to do the 7 and the 14. But that's a decision down the road. And these amounts could change in the future based on whatever TMRS is doing.
And you said that back in May and June of 19, that when this was originally brought up, that there was pushback from the members themselves?
So when we first, years ago, actually, when I actually researched the plan amendment elections that have happened over the last 20 years in the plan, the only elections that actually ever failed were, I think, 3 times when the system tried to get the staff into the regular plan. So that was back then when plan amendments were done by the membership. But when we looked at it before, I personally didn't hear any pushback from the members. But I know from hearing from Joe Schutz, I think he thought, and maybe some other board members I can't remember, thought it might not look good to the membership if we change. But I'm not sure why they would care, because it doesn't impact their benefit. And that's when we were looking at doing a separate defined benefit plan, separate from the main system plan.
Well, I can address that last statement, because I had some members call me last night that were reviewing the agenda items for today, and one of the very first comments is, so you're telling me that somebody that works for the DPFP is going to have a better pension than I am. So that's a concern. It's a real concern for our members. And then just with the lack of public comment, it was put on the agenda for today, and you're asking us to approve it today. They felt like it was being pushed through. So at a minimum, I'm going to ask that we table this item and push it to next month, just to give our members some time to comment on it and weigh in.
So I can tell you that this is in no way a better pension plan than the members have.
Right.
I mean, it's just not at all, in no sense of the word. And I respect that. We don't have to make a decision now. We do need to get ahead of the legislation if we're going to get it in there. We can talk next month about it when Hilco's there. You know, but at some point we have to do the right thing for the employees as well. I mean,
I agree.
You know, this is not. I mean, this is not a better pension plan than the members have. Not in any way, shape, or form.
Hey, Kelly,
this is Steve Ito. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, this is a memorandum out there explaining it and what the benefits could or would be versus what the members, the association plan is, just so people have more of the facts in front of them.
Okay.
This is Gilbert, if I could, Bill.
And Kelly, there is no doubt we need to do the right thing for the employees. No doubt. And I was one that I think pushed it, you know, that was opposed last time. So I'm happy to sort of own some of that. At the end of the day, it's not about is it better or worse. It's more about we're either jumping in the boat all together or kind of we're not. And I think that's a lot of the feeling by some of the membership and retirees. And, you know, my comments last time were the wounds were still open. I think the wounds are now healing some, but my other issue now becomes not wounds, but, you know, we don't want to have any blemish if we're about to ask the voters something. And, you know, having done lots of campaigns, right? And to have something, any nuance of, well, there's this and there's that, could really take the focus away from the financial status of the plan and trying to get a POB or something like that. So those are my reasons. I mean, it's just timing. Would you just refresh our memory? Because I know it happened sort of before I came and some of us came. What was the reason why some people were against joining our plan again? If you could just go through that one more time.
Well, so the joining our plan, like, are you asking about the DPFP staff being part of the DPFP plan, pension plan?
Right. I remember vaguely that when Nick and I and Bill first came in, there was some about before there were some strong feelings about you not joining our plan or something to that effect. Could you just refresh our history on that?
So back a long time ago, way before my time, there were three different elections where the system tried to change the pension plan to allow the staff in there, and the membership voted that down all three times. So we know clearly the members do not want DPFP staff in the pension plan. I don't know why they don't. To me, that's not logical, but that is how they feel. To me, you would think that they would want everybody in the same boat, but they've said no three times, so that's pretty clear. But even if they wanted them in now, that's not their choice anymore. Now it's the legislature's choice. So if we wanted to try to push that now, that requires a legislative change down at the Capitol. The members can no longer do that. So that is just not worth it. It's not, number one, we don't want to open up our bill until we have to open up our bill. So we certainly don't want to do it for that, and we know the members would probably be opposed to that.
Well, I just think it's important to the chairman's comment about a memorandum or something that some of this history's in there so people know it was kind of attempted at one time, and the very people that might be concerned about it are the very people that didn't want it. I just think going through some of the history is important to put out there. That's all.
Okay.
Hey, Kelly, this is Ken. Let me expand on your answer to Gilbert and maybe make this a little bit clearer for Gilbert, since I was part of all three of those votes when I was on the department. The main reason, it seemed, why the members did not want the pension employees in our system was because they felt that would give an opportunity or open the door for all city employees to be allowed to come into our plan and potentially, have any problems that might be associated with civilian employees coming in. So that was the reason. It was just a conspiracy theory on my part that what I thought they wanted, which I thought was foolish, and it wasn't logical at all, like Kelly said. So that's kind of the reason why it got voted down three times.
Yeah, and Kelly, this is Steve Ido, and I agree with everyone what they're saying. I think we should delay this, for a month, have a memorandum that explains it. And my thoughts is that what you said, that I can't thank enough you enough and the staff enough for what you guys do. And certainly, this is what I do for a living. I help employers figure out their total reward strategy. And you're right. I mean, a pension plan is a much better benefit than a defined contribution plan. But defined contribution plans are what's most prevalent in today's world. But I'd also be curious to see to make sure that we're making you guys whole from a retirement perspective. But what does it fit in from a total reward strategy? How do you benchmark against with the medical plan that you're offered, the compensation, paid time off? Let's look at all of that and make sure that we're in line with that and understand where those benchmarks are, because the last thing we want to do is to have a recruiting or retention problem. So I want you, I support that. But the second thing that I do think of as well is I can't help but to think about maybe family offices, private equity funds, and oftentimes you see a lot of those people that work for that private equity fund invest their own dollars in that private equity fund, or a chief investment officer invests their money in that family office fund. And I worry about the optics, what that might look like when we go to Austin and we're talking about it, of what it might look like if the staff is not invested alongside the members in the Dallas Police and Fire Pension Fund. It was my immediate thought, but I would be happy on a pro bono basis to help in any way I could to do a total rewards benchmarking study for the staff of the pension to make sure that we don't have any gaps. And if we do have gaps, we understand where they are and where we might be above it to work in other areas.
That's great. Steve, we actually are in the process of doing a compensation study, including kind of total comp. And we had hoped to have that on this agenda, but it will actually be in January. And I'll take you up on your offer and have you help us when we're getting preliminary results back and see if you think we need to delve deeper in certain areas or, what your impressions are once we get the data back.
Thank you. I'm happy to do that because I just, and it's important, too, that the staff feels the value of all the benefits that are being, offered to you, because you are such an important part of what you're doing for this system. And so let's just make sure we have all those data points for you. I'm happy to help any way that I can.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Hey, Kelly, it's Armando. Just one final comment. I want to be very clear that I want to make sure you guys know that it's not that I don't support or appreciate what y'all are doing. It's the fact that I have members calling me and wanting to be a part of it, but having an opinion. And I think it's respectful to listen to their concerns at this point. But you know my position, my personal position on this. We've spoken at length about it. I think recruiting and retention is very important for our staff. And I think for us to recover in the manner that we want to recover, we have to have the best and the brightest on our staff. And I think this is one more way of doing that. I just think we need to give it an opportunity and let our members weigh in a little bit. And then we'll do the right thing at the end of the day.
So can I say something?
Okay, great.
Sure. Okay, so I think that the general consensus is that you guys, this is something that needs to be addressed. And I don't think that anyone would disagree that it needs to be provided for as a compensation package altogether. All other staff members and other pensions have something like this, except it appears our staff. That's the first thing. The second thing is, while there was some discussion that PMRS is not better per se, but it's healthier, and that's part of the optics. I think that there should be, just because before it was not agreeable, I think it still should be on the table or at least revisited to be part of ours. Because coming
to be
some
part
of our,
what
I mean,
do you mean
like
by that?
To the point, because I'm not sure, because it said that we were, that you were not allowed to be in ours because it was voted against membership. Is that correct?
Well, that was why we weren't in the past. But now, because of the legislative change, only the legislature can change the bill to allow us to do that. So I don't think it's worth going to the legislature to try to change the plan to allow the members, to allow the staff to be in the system, especially given the fact we know the membership doesn't want that or didn't want that in the past.
I would, let me add, Kelly, I mean, as we would be fiduciaries to the staff plan, and for us to vote to take them from 100% fully funded plan, albeit it's a DC plan, to a DB plan that's 40% funded, I don't think would be a fiduciarily sound decision that any, you know, fiduciaries who's making decisions solely in the best interest of those beneficiaries would ever make outside of this. So I really don't see where that would fly at all from our fiduciary standpoint.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think it would be hard to, I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense to do that for the, like from the employee standpoint. It actually makes more sense for the employees to quit and go get their Social Security credits and then come back.
Well, why don't you look at all of these for next month and come back and we'll have a lengthier discussion on what our preliminary steps are. Anything we were going to do today, which we can defer a month, was not going to be a permanent decision to do it other than just to start pursuing it. So let's handle it next month in more depth.
Okay, and Hoko will be here next month so they can talk about
stuff. Is that, Armando, I really want to understand what the nature of the complaints were that you were hearing again.
Yeah, and we beat this pretty hard, but we can have an offline conversation if you want, or I can just tell you that they didn't like the fact that that people were going to be in a 90% funded plan versus a 45% funded plan. You know, that was the main thing. That was, they're going to have a better pension than we are, and that's one of them. The second one was, to, I can't remember who said it, but if we're in this together, let's all be in this together. Let's all work to make this pension stronger, better together, and not, you know, picking and choosing. So those were the two main complaints that I got last night.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, this is
okay,
Alan.
So
can I,
Kelly,
add one.
Thanks.
I don't have all the institutional knowledge that a lot of you do, since this discussion predates me on the board. But, you know, looking through it, I had some of the concerns that were raised about, you know, basically just everyone being in the same boat and this together. But this has been helpful for me to understand what's happened. But putting on my prior legislator hat, I think it would be helpful for Hilco to come in next month and explain to us, you know, the steps that would need to be taken, you know, whether to add staff to TMRS or, assuming the members are okay, the staff to our pension, because it would take legislative action, I think, both ways, if I'm correct. So it'd be good just to know, you know, what they think timeline-wise. And because as I understand it, too, even if the legislation got amended, it wouldn't mean automatically that staff is going to TMRS. That decision would be ultimately decided later, right?
Well, I think if the legislation changed, yes, I think the board then later could decide to go in or not go in. It wouldn't be mandatory. But once you made that decision, then all the employees would have to go in. It wouldn't be, some could choose to and some would not.
Yeah, and our legislature meets once every 2 years for a very narrow window of time, and, you know, typically about 6 months, but there's even a more narrow window of time within that time frame to get legislation passed. So, if this is something that we wanted to move forward with, either one of them, either option, we need to be ready to have that ball rolling as the legislature convenes in about a month. So that's all I've got.
Yeah, January 12th. Yep. So we will bring it back in January. Hilco will be here. They'll be able to talk about the process. We will have the compensation study information available at that time. I'll have put together some other information that you've requested, and we'll be able to talk about it then. And then hopefully we'll be able to get the legislation moving at that time, because the session opens the 12th, and I think bills are being submitted already at this point.
Kelly, I would just add to that. I think over the course of the next month, you should engage, you know, one or two trustees kind of for feedback along the way, so that you kind of get, you know, a little bit of a feedback loop as you generate thoughts and directions and all that kind of thing.
Okay. Thank you.
And who would that be, just so that we all are clear?
This is Rob French.
I'd like to be included on that. Much like Steve, I do executive benefits in the private sector, and matching executive interest to the general interests of the rest of the folks. So, and as a non-mayoral appointee, I'd like to be included on this process.
Yeah, Rob, I think that's a really good point. That gives a little, you know, perception of checks and balances, and I don't mind reaching out to the different association leaders and setting up some sort of a conference with them and getting the pulse of their memberships also.
Okay, so that's one last thing. There's twofold, like Alan was also alluding to. It's like going to legislate the legislature and actually, you know, pushing for an optionality for staff. But the second one is understanding what are all the options. And I think it's very important that you kind of go down and say, ERS is not an option because we're not a city employee. Dallas, what's the issue with police in Dallas? And why TMRS? Or not, and another plan. I just think that there should be some kind of matrix involved in that as well.
Okay. I can put that together.
Yeah, and I think that the goal is a solution here. So while we are kind of deferring it, you know, that Kelly, I make the comment so that we're moving towards a solution that everyone's on board with. So I just think that, you know, involving the people who can best give you touch points and feedback along the way just makes a lot of sense in this case, knowing that we do need to come up with a solution. This isn't a, you know, do, don't do type thing. It's, we must do it. How are we going to do it?
I agree.
And Kelly, this is Gilbert. I'm around if you need me to. I don't want to have too many people involved, but obviously I'm around if you need me to.
All right. I appreciate that. Thank you all.
And we're on time, so if there's nothing else, we'll move to Kent. And are the people from Makita on the line as well?
They are. I confirmed by email that Leo and Aaron are on the line.
Okay. All right. Kent, do you want to do a portfolio update?
Yeah, sure. I'll take it. Thank you, Nick. And, John, if you can go ahead and just page forward to 253. This is our adjusted asset allocation. So we show our book NAV on the second column there, and then we have adjustments, which is staff's view of likely impairment of certain assets or kind of additional value adjustments, taking into account COVID and energy, to come to our adjusted NAV, you know, versus our asset allocation targets and some variances there. Just a couple things to point out here. At the last meeting, the board approved our recommendation to liquidate global bonds, and we actually did that, you know, relatively quickly. And so you'll see global bonds kind of in the middle of the page is down to zero. We actually took $71 million out of that, and we put $13 million into investment grade bonds. So right above that, you'll see that we're right on target for investment grade bonds. And we put $16 million into emerging market debt. And so that went from about a 1.1% to now a 2% allocation. We discussed all that kind of at the, it was part of the plan for global fixed income. So on the last part of that, then, is we're running a little bit heavy on cash, and that is you know, targeted for future payments. And so that's really it on that page. And I'll move on to the next page, and I'm assuming someone will shout out if you've got any questions. Try to keep it moving. Next page, John, 254. Okay, there we are. Sorry. Looking at my own sheet. So here, just a couple things to point out. First of all, kind of a qualifier. This is just recent performance, and so I try to mention this every now and then, that this is not kind of the total evaluation of our managers. It's just what's been happening lately. And, you know, the evaluation of the managers has to look over a long period of time and include other factors. But in terms of what's been going on lately, the thing that I'm most pleased to see is that as value and small cap has been working as we go into the fourth quarter, we're seeing Boston Partners, which has been lagging significantly, bounce right back. And so they're our strongest performer for the quarter. And it's just 2 months, and they're still kind of the worst year to date, but that shows that kind of what we thought was going on is going on, and they're, you know, bouncing back like expected. And so the others are all kind of trending as expected. Manulife, which is a value manager, the quality factor there, which has worked over the long term, and they're quite strong performer longer term, that hasn't worked in 2020. And then with regard to fixed income, really everything's working. If you look on the far right in terms of year to date, the positives are all in kind of our big allocations, and then the negatives are either in kind of transitions or smaller impacts. So real strong performance from income research, 324 excess return, you know, going down to Longfellow, just invested in July, but, you know, a little bit of negative performance kind of for the year, but still strong. Brandywine were out of that, but they've made up a lot in the last month there. And Loomis High Yield, again, a positive in every quarter in 2020. Moving it to the next page, and I just threw this impact estimate back in here to just show you how much money we're making in, just in the October, November. So recall that the, you know, what this does is it takes those allocations, and what we try to do is estimate it. And it's a rough estimate of kind of how the manager performance is you know, working through to the bottom line. And so, you know, our estimate is that year to date, public markets have added $100 million to the portfolio. And recall that was a negative 150 at the end of March 2020. So it's, you know, kind of up 250 since then, and that's coming primarily from global equities, and you know, also a fair amount from fixed income. So just I thought that was interesting. I wanted to share that with you. Any other questions there? Okay, moving forward to the initiatives. So I had a kind of a talk before about both kind of all the focus we have in private equity, and we've talked about how Hough Energy, we've seen quite a bit of valuation volatility there. It went up about $100 million in 2019, and or actually 2018, we mentioned that we thought that would come back down, and it did. And so we've actually been doing quite a bit of work behind the scenes there. And there's a memo in your materials that kind of goes through all of that. And I apologize, perhaps it was the materials were too extensive, but you know, hopefully the staff memo summarizes the key factors there. And the main thing I don't want to go into a big discussion about that because it is a sensitive private equity investment, but the things I want to mention are that, you know, we're engaged with other LPs, we're engaged with appropriate advisors, we're engaged with a general partner. The fund is kind of near its end of term expiration, although these are, it's an energy asset, and we're going to have to be, it entails kind of continued valuation risk, and we're going to have to be, the general partner will have to be prudent in kind of how we manage this asset going forward. And that's really about all I could, there's a lot of work going on there, but really about all we can talk about in an open session. The other thing, the global equity mentioned here that we've got a recommendation for the meeting. Actually going to not make that recommendation. And further on in the materials, it mentions that we had identified BlackRock ACWI IMI index product recommendation. But we were, the investment advisory committee, you know, as part of this process, as we review the managers and for a passive product, the hope was that we would identify a product and could, get the investment advisory committee comfortable with that. But there were a couple of questions that came out just in the last couple of days regarding the securities lending within this index product that we just want to take a little bit of time and evaluate with the investment advisory committee and evaluate what our options are. And Gilbert, you were kind of key in some of those conversations. Do you want to make any other comments about that?
Sure. There's a lot of things in that fund related to securities lending and other expenses. And at the end of the day, you know, one can be for them or one can be against them, but there are alternative funds that don't have those nuances. And so we just wanted to make comparisons of apples to apples. I'm sure we'll do something, right? So it's just a function of making sure we do the right thing. That's it.
Thank you, Gilbert. So I already talked about the global bond transition. We approved the change to the – you approved the change to the Loomis High Yield product, and we're working our way through that. On the global equity, I do want to spend a minute and with Makita kind of talking about what that structure – where we're heading with that structure. And I think that's it for this page. Next slide, John. We've done for the last couple of years an investment review kind of month by month, making our way through the portfolio. And so this is our proposed schedule for next year. It always changes, but it's just a plan to make sure we get to touch all the managers as we go through the year. We've heard kind of some feedback in the last couple of meetings about the presentations, you know, on board days kind of being a little bit too much detail. So we're really going to target, I think we'll have as much detail in the documentation, but we'll strive to be more hitting the highlights in our presentations and keep those presentations tighter. And you can keep the feedback coming, whether we're on target or, you know, want more, want less, want something different. And I had indicated before, you know, this might be a good time for feedback as well. And so I just wanted to stop for a second if there's any other requests or suggestions or perspective regarding, you know, how we've been going through the plan. Maybe you don't want to do it at all. And I think we have to have some way to kind of go through the plan, but let me know your thoughts on that. Any comments right now? Okay.
Ken, I would say that the calendar looks good, and I think you do a good job of keeping us up to date and interjecting our external business partners where it makes sense. The one thing I would like to do, I want you to finish any comments you have, is maybe have, because our next item will be the advisory committee reappointments, is have Gilbert kind of talk a little bit about the committee, what it's been doing, what it hopes to be doing that it hasn't done thus far, as kind of a tee up to us reappointing it. So, Ken, if you want to make any comments on how you've engaged with that committee, in addition to anything else you want to say.
Sure. So I think that would be a good segue to just turn to the next slide, 258. And we have regularly scheduled meeting with the Investment Advisory Committee on a quarterly basis, and we're more focused. Kind of it's assumed that they've all read the board materials. All the board materials are made available to the committee, and then they will bring up, you know, particular issues that are of concern or suggestions that they have. And then we have been spending more time with the committee in terms of the structures. So the committee was intimately involved kind of over a series of meetings on the global equity structure we're going to talk about in a little bit, as well as the investment manager search and selection process. So we really kind of had our first run of that with the investment grade bond search earlier this year. And I think we all felt like it was that worked well in terms of the investment advisory committee approving the process that we were going forward, staff keeping them updated along the way, and then ultimately, approving of the recommendation and forwarding that kind of recommendation to the board. And we've been getting a lot of involvement and help across the board. It's a solid team, so I want to thank everyone. But Gilbert, your thoughts?
Sure. I'll take one step back, which is it is very common that a pension board, and I've served on other pension boards, has an investment committee, just like we have an audit committee, just like many have a disability committee. And the reason is there's just too much in a board meeting to go through and to go through all the detail. And the reason is the investments are, have to take great care, and they on themselves could be a two-hour meeting. And so just about every board has an investment committee of some sort. So I want to make sure people know that first. Second, by statute for our fund, because of some of the challenges we had, we have an investment advisory committee, and it is defined by having certain members that are trustees and certain members that are outside. That's a little bit more uncommon, but it's not to completely uncommon. And I think it's a reflection of the state of affairs of our board from before. So at the end of the day, I think it's totally fine. And every trustee should feel welcome to attend any of these. So don't think that, this is just for these two or three trustees. Anyone can come. But as far as getting business done, there are voting members. And everyone should know this is a very high-powered group. Ignoring the trustees, when you look at the external members, you're talking about people with 25, 35, 40 years experience. And they've all either have run a large pension fund or are running a large pension fund or an endowment type situation. And one person in particular, Scott Freeman, is one of the most senior consultants in the business. He's been a consultant for probably 35 years. So he knows all these managers. He knows all the consultants. He's been in the business that long as a senior consultant. And so my view is we're in good shape. And I think as far as what could we be doing a little bit different or better, the Investment Advisory Committee had a lot of changes just at the beginning. So I think we're now in a rhythm. And the change is related to we were just having changes with trustees, as we all know. And so now I think it's in a rhythm, and I think the staff is now in the same rhythm. And so rather than us have these board meetings that are, 5-6 hours, we don't want to shortchange the investments. So my view is we should really, use the board time wisely, and a lot of the minutiae that's very important, but yet it's somewhat minutiae, on the investment should be in the Investment Advisory Committee forum, because we don't want to shortchange that type of analysis, especially since the staff works so hard. But every trustee should feel comfortable to attend at any time. So those are the things that I would say, Nick. I think it's a very high-powered committee, especially the non-trustees. And again, I want everyone to know it's very, very common to have an investment committee, and having outside trustee members just gives you even better depth and perspective. And that's all I have, Nick.
Great. And I would just add, I know Robert Jones, I know Bob Jones well, work with him professionally, and I consider him top of the game as well. So it's great to hear we have such high pedigreed good people in these external roles. So I think that what we need to do here is we'd like to make a motion to reappoint all the people listed here with the knowledge that we're going to be working through, I guess, some bylaws relative to the policy or the investment policy statement, and we're going to stagger the termination dates in a way that's not represented here. Or is this how we're proposing we stagger them, Kelly?
Nick, I'll just jump in here. First of all, I noticed as I was reviewing things that I left off the column headings here. So the date that comes right after their name is the date they were appointed, and the last column is would be the expiration date of their term if the reappointments were approved. And what we'll plan on doing is coming back as some of these next November, and reestablishing the staggered term so that we aren't having, the majority of the people all expire at the same time.
Okay. And then, Kent, to Gilbert's point, how are we informing the entire board when these meetings or calls are occurring so that if they want to participate or listen in, they can?
Well, I think we have to be careful about that. So, Josh, you want to, can you, if you're available, can you kind of talk about some of the sensitivities around that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think people are welcome to listen in if they would like to, but obviously you've got open meetings issues about having a quorum presence of trustees. But if people from time to time, one or two people want to listen in or I don't think there's any issues with that. It just can't be a large number.
Okay.
And of course, Nick, they would be. And Nick, of course, the other thing too is they would be non-voting participants.
Yes.
Yeah. And Josh, we'd have to. I guess we would be limited to a maximum of two additional board members. Otherwise, we would have a quorum of the board. Is that right?
That is. Well, I guess. I mean, technically, you could have three, I guess, because there's no. I'm sorry, two. Two. You're right. Yes, two. Yeah.
Okay. So,
so just let us know, board members, if any of y'all are interested. Yeah, and we'll let you know.
Okay, so how about that anyone that wants to participate and just listen in, they have to sort of contact Gilbert beforehand so that he is aware of the total number and who, and he can manage that accordingly relative to what Josh just said.
That's perfect, Nick.
I think the only thing I would add to that is you need to publish a schedule of when the meetings are so people will know when they are.
We can understand.
Thank you.
We can do that. It may already be out there on the website. I'm not sure, but it actually probably isn't on the website. But yeah, we can do that.
Yeah, Kelly, if you just be kind enough to send that to everybody, just so they have it.
Okay.
All right.
Quick question for Josh, real quick. If members are just listening in, and there's more than three. I mean, does that still run afoul of having a quorum? I mean, if they're not speaking, they're just listening in?
Yeah, I think to be safe, I think that's not really appropriate.
Okay.
Yeah, we might want to check on that, Josh. This is Mark. I know like at DFW, they have committee meetings, and I'm not quite certain exactly how they work, but other parties members can not participate, but at least attend. We may want to, you may have already checked that as to how they do that.
So are those public meetings, Mark? Are those publicly posted, the committee meetings?
I think they're publicly posted, and maybe that's the solution. You just publicly post them. If people, unless you're taking action, which you're really, I think it's a question of what type of action you're taking. If you're on a committee, that's going to be eventually taken up by the board.
Well, that's the issue
Yeah, let me add more. Let me just, Josh, real quick, let me just add something to that. So, number one, the committee, what it does, it will take action, but the actions are recommendations to the board. The board is the only one with the authority to really take definitive action. So we're making recommendations. The other thing is, people might recall, it was my desire to make these public meetings originally at the first place, but I was overruled at the chairman at the time. not Chairman Bill Quinn, the chairman of this committee, who wanted it to not be public. I'm very happy with this being public, and in fact, I'll state my same position, which is I think the members should know what's going on with their money. And so I'm very happy if we make these public meetings.
I will just say, this is Kent, that there is I really value the unvarnished and candid feedback from the investment advisory members, and that my expectation would be that in the public session that the value, the potential value to staff of kind of that candid feedback could be diminished, and I'd have to weigh that against everything else. So,
well, Kent, as the chairman, I can tell you point.
Dynamic.
Yeah, Kent, I could tell you as the chairman, there is no way being a public session is going to varnish anything that I'm going to say, and knowing these committee members that I know, nothing's going to change their views either. It could affect the staff. But that's there's nothing I can do about that. But as it relates to all of us, you know, it's not going to hinder us one bit.
I think
well,
it, the
I
impact
also will
is
add,
really talking
another,
about. If I can just
I'm
add,
sorry,
the,
I was just
the
gonna,
thing we're worried about is not it's not that we're not being open and honest with the members. It's that there are times we need to talk about real estate values, and we don't want to do that in an open session because that could impact a negotiation, or oftentimes. You know, we are in a litigation or a pre-litigation mode on some of our other investments that we're not wanting to talk about in public. So we're not trying to hide information
yep.
from the membership, but it just would
well,
make it a little more challenging to talk about everything.
Yeah. Well,
yeah,
I certainly understand
Mark,
that,
but it's
no different. Go ahead, Mark. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and this might be another for another call, but there are other entities that have pensions like DFW Airport or certain cities where it is public. People can go and participate in it. It may be posted as a public meeting. That doesn't preclude you from using all the opportunities under the law to make sure you're being able to make the best decision. So I don't know exactly why we are treating this fund differently than possibly, at least I know one or two, why we're treating it that differently.
Yeah, and let me just jump in one more time if I could, which is, and Kelly, you're right, it's not about hiding this or that. At the end of the day, though, it should be run just like a regular board meeting, and so if there are items that are deemed that you cannot have it in public, we would just go to closed session, no different. It's conducted the same way, Robert's rules the same way. And again, at the time, it was just a preference by the chairman, Ray. I don't think he really had a whole lot of reason why other than it was his preference. My preference is to make it open. And that's every board I've been on, every investor committee, everything else I've done many, they've all been open. The reality is very few people from the public go because it's very, very detailed, and that's just the reality. Very few will even go.
Gilbert, what I would suggest, why don't you query the external members on that issue? You know, the other people, the board members are on it. Maybe talk to Kelly, Josh, and Kent, and then come back with a solid view next month on this, whether open or closed.
That's perfect. Thank you, Nick. I think that's a brilliant idea. And again, I didn't mean for it to go this direction. But yeah, I think let's do our homework and then we can be more thoughtful. So count on that.
Yeah, because you may have an external member who Ray sort of proffered it one way and you don't want to change it without their, you know, saying that they understood that or didn't understand that. So I think you need to do a little bit of work and so we're, I think, seeing it the same way now.
Totally agree. Thank you, Nick.
Okay. All right. Okay, so Kent, per your prior comment, we're not going to we're going to erase item 12, the global equity structure, and that thing that you mentioned with BlackRock and in the MSCI, ACWI, correct?
No, I still want to just briefly talk about the equity structure. I think we,
okay.
I don't think we have approved the reappointments yet, so we need to make sure we.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. No, you're right. I'm sorry. I missed that. Let me just go back and do that. It's QB2 is clearly showing he's not QB1. Okay, so we want a motion to reappoint Gilbert Garcia, Scott Freeman, and Robert Jones to serve on the Investment Advisory Committee for the 2-year terms ending 12/31/22, knowing that in a subsequent time we probably will restructure those terms to have a staggered termination date. Can I have a first on that motion?
Armando with a first.
A second?
Steve Idle, second.
Rob.
Okay, any comments? All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. Kent, thank you for the nudge on that. Anything you want to say on the global equity structure?
Yes, yeah, so I want to spend a couple minutes here, and I think Leo and Makita might have a couple of follow-on comments. So we have a presentation, or the Makita presentation, that starts on page 260, and we have a history in there that kind of goes back, you know, all the way to the structure study they did several quarters ago, and then details kind of various milestones and the involvement of the Investment Advisory Committee along the way. I'm not going to go through all of that. It's there for your review. And I want to move forward to slide 268. And this is the proposed structure. And one of the considerations was how much risk do we want to have with one manager? So if we had have an asset allocation to global equity of 40%, and so that would be a 10% allocation to each of the managers in the current structure. And it's kind of abnormally high. And when I went and looked at, you know, the contributions to tracking error to the overall portfolio, it really wasn't a concern, but just having kind of that much of the portfolio with one manager, even though it's a separately managed account that is, you know, that we custody, that was a consideration. So you'll see here that we have limited each of the managers to 7%. Presentation kind of goes on. We looked at whether we should risk weight them or equal weight them, and, you know, in the end, I think we all viewed that simple or was better and just have these equal weights, and the risk contributions are not that different in either approach. You'll see that we've added a passive. It's the ACWI, which is the All Country World Index, and so that is all the companies in the world. IMI stands for Investable Market Index, so rather than just the larger companies, that index includes small cap as well. And the recommended allocation there is 6% of the total of DPFP. And then the other thing we noticed in the structure study was that we would be underweight to small cap. Some of our managers, they have the ability to go down and invest in small cap managers. Generally, they don't kind of get a full appetite or, you know, full exposure to small cap. So we would need some small cap exposure to give us comprehensive coverage. And so we would anticipate searching for small cap managers in 2021, breaking that into kind of a U.S. component and a non-U.S. component. If you look on the next slide, 269, it kind of goes through some of the things I just talked about, as well as Makita's view. And Leo, I'll ask you if you want to make any additional comments about your process and your views of the structure.
Thank you, Kent. This is Leo. Good morning, everybody. I'm also joined by Aaron. This is the process that has been in the works for multiple years. I guess in the interest of time, I'll just highlight that we started with these equal weighted approach to the active managers, as Kent alluded to, I think it was on 268, and we look at how risk is accounted for under that structure, and then we consider also, well, strategies may not contribute equal amount of risk to a portfolio. What about the equal weight based upon risk contribution? The returns weren't terribly different, but it presented more complications in terms of how often you rerun that risk-based model. And ultimately, the conclusion, which was jointly arrived at by staff at Takeda, was that the equal-weighted approach based on capital allocation was very reasonable, easy to implement, and not materially different from alternatives. And that is the conclusion and the recommendation. I'll stop there. We can provide a lot more color to the history that has been reviewed for over multiple years, and it has gone to the committee at times as well. And we have many conversations also with staff, many back and forth. So I'll pause there, Aaron, if I missed something that you want to add. Otherwise, we're happy to stand by and answer any questions.
Let me ask a question, Leo. I'm on the board of the railroad, and it's a big fund, but we clearly are seeing, you know, their pressure about certain investments in China that are on the OFAC list that are restricted by to U.S. investors, and now there's a more recent executive order that may expand that list next year. In separate accounts, we can work for that, but how do we do that with the ACWI IMI index? Are we going to be stuck in some investments that we are prohibited from?
With separately managed accounts, you can do whatever you want as long as the managers agree to your request.
Right.
I suspect that would be fairly easy to do. With commingled product, you take them as they are, or you can work to create a new sleeve or a new share class, if you will, without China. It's still pretty new, but there may be enough demand from multiple clients to do so. I think it's a very fluid conversation. Who knows what's going to happen with the new administration, assuming it comes, you know. So it's something we can continue to monitor and report, and or if the maybe it's a good topic to address with the investment committee as well.
I mean, I think the index product is the only one we couldn't address easily, but I think that's some of those companies have been on the list quite a while, even before this administration. So we need to be thinking thoughtful about that as we go forward.
This is Kent, and so we have kept our eye on that particular issue. I mean, right now that's just applying to federal plans, and so a lot of the restrictions that apply are the restrictions that apply federally as well as state restrictions, you know, do not work their way down to our level. And so it's something that we want to continue to keep an eye on, but we're not viewing potential divestment as something that should drive the plan right now.
Okay. Just to move on to slide 274, please, John, just as a this is just a place where we summarize kind of Makeda's view and all the things we just talked about. And then, you know, we'll be back hopefully very quickly with a recommendation on the index fund. And I think Nick will probably want to just move it right on into Makeda to give us their performance review. No, I'll let you do that.
Yes, yeah.
All right, thanks, Kat. Okay. This is Aaron with Makeda. If you could go to 285, please. So in the spirit of Kent's comments and Gilbert's comments about the role of the IAC versus the board meeting forum, I will be brief, and I'm going to try to just touch the high points, covering about four slides here. So third quarter was a good quarter for equity markets. Equity markets were up about 8%. Bond markets were positive as well, depending on which index, but, you know, about 1% or so. But you can see DPSP's quarterly return was minus 2.1%, which was significantly below your policy benchmark, which was up about 5.5%. So that underperformance is singularly explained by private equity, and specifically the Hough Energy valuation that was previously mentioned, which was essentially cut in half. So that's the key driver explaining why I see so much red on this page, and the key driver pulling down the peer ranking and everything else in the quarter. If you look to that gray bar halfway through active management where it says mixed, you know, we're generally pleased overall with what we're seeing from your liquid strategies, your public markets managers. So a little more than half outperformed in the quarter. And throughout the year, you know, as Kent mentioned previously, they're performing as expected. Growth managers are doing well when growth is a tailwind, and vice versa when you see value doing well, which has been a lot less frequent. Go to page 300, please. So, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words. So this is an attribution chart that shows the magnitude that that private equity updated valuation had in the quarter. So if you're looking at this chart and you're looking at that vertical black line, that if you have an orange dot on the black line, that means your asset class contributed exactly the same as the policy benchmark. So you see really the obvious is that private equity is the giant anchor, the tail that wagged the dog in the quarter. And unfortunately, we're seeing, you know, this has been the story for the last few years where your private market portfolio, your liquid markets investments have just been such an anchor to the rest of the fund. If you go to 303, please.
Aaron, this is Kent. Just one comment to make about that. I mean, is that as we look at that in the quarter and the year, I mean, we had that same kind of dynamic of the opposite way whenever Huff wrote those assets up, kind of based on equity valuations in 2018. So it has been volatile, but that's not to take away from the comment that kind of there's been this overall drag related to that. But then that particular big magnitude was something that went up and then came back down in private equity.
Yeah, certainly. And I know, you know, staff, I don't want to say called it, but you guys certainly made the board aware that there was a high likelihood you could see this round trip back to where we ended up this quarter with the talk there. But this chart here introduces standard deviation into the conversation. We're always talking about just returns. And it compares DPFP on a return and volatility chart against peer plans that are $1 to $5 billion pension plans. So you're obviously the green square, and all those pink dots are peers. So what you see is you're really far to the left on the standard deviation basis. So there's a lot less, aside from Huff, there's been a lot less swings in your quarterly returns. And that's, you know, it makes sense. You have this big chunk of your portfolio that doesn't mark to market to the same extent that other peer plan investments might be doing so. So when equity markets rally strongly, like they did in the third quarter, you're not rallying to the same extent. But conversely, in something like the first quarter, you're not losing as much when equity markets, you know, fall off a cliff. So you definitely have a lot less volatility from standard deviation perspective than peers. But unfortunately, you also see you're really far south relative to peers in the resulting returns you've earned. On the spirit of peer analysis, I'm going to close with 307. One more, please. No, sorry, this is the correct one. So this is an imperfect exercise, but we try to find ways to compare the portion of the fund that the trustees and staff and Makita can has a bit more influence over. So this is the fund performance excluding private market investment. So that's the green circle. The blue squares are pure pension plans. And then the triangle is a 60-40, just as a kind of a ballpark barometer. So you can see, most importantly, you're not an outlier from this metric. If you look at the bottom in the gray line where it says total fund ex privates, and you look in the parentheses, that's your ranking. So year to date, you know, top third, 1 year, almost top third, and 3 years about median. And this is, you know, it's even with the acknowledgement that your public market portion of the fund is not built in isolation. So you remember the concept of the safety reserve and that significant portion in high quality bonds and cash is a balancer to the unpredictability of the outcome on some of these private markets. So your public portion of the fund is doing really well, considering that it's actually invested much more conservatively than you could argue that some of these other pure funds are invested. So if you look at the green circle to the triangle, you're right up there with a 60-40 mix when you're closer to a 50% equity, 50% bond mix. So I'll end there. The themes are the same this quarter. Generally, the public markets managers are working. The policy asset allocation is working. It's just the fund still hasn't been able to get there, given the slow and challenging process of unwinding these illiquid investments.
Kent, when you synthesize this sort of feedback and deal with the reality of, you know, reality is the entire portfolio, but you are interested in the things that you, your team, and your advisors can influence and control, what conclusions, implications, what feedback, how would you want us to think about this situation?
Well, I'm really on the same page as what Aaron just said. I don't want
to. Far away. We're like at least five away.
This has to be an Uber because they said.
Hey, Gilbert, can you go on mute?
I think that's him on.
Okay, this is Kent. I'm responding to Nick's question about the, you know, how do I look at this and how do I think about the portfolio? So. This is a slide and kind of something that I keep track of, and I really like the way Aaron laid it up, and it's how I think about it, and including kind of the fact that we have that, I don't want to call it drag, but all the amount that the 13 or 12% that's in short-term investment-grade bonds will be a drag on kind of positive performance. But I think all the points he made are good in terms of that we're basically keeping up with other funds and with a 60-40 portfolio. And then, you know, the other reason that portfolio performance slide that I show kind of every meeting is really how I look at and how I think about and keep my finger on the pulse of the managers. As I mentioned, it's a multi-year, multi-faceted approach to evaluating a manager, but wanting to understand kind of every month and every quarter why a manager's outperforming or underperforming. And, you know, for our global equity managers, we basically kept up with the index in a very tough year overall, and we understand kind of what's going on, and I feel real good about that. And on the fixed income side, I think we have a really good set of managers that is, you know, I think we're improving on the margin. So those are my kind of response to your question, Nick.
But I mean, I'm really, guess, looking more for your thoughts on how you think through monetizing out the private equity portfolio, sort of, you know, preserving marks or hopefully enhancing marks relative to creating liquidity. How do you think through all that?
So on the private market assets, you know, we talk about that as we go through these individual reviews of the managers and kind of the our philosophy and my philosophy is walk, don't run towards the exits. So we're looking at the earliest fair value exit for these things, and we're going to talk about one of these, you know, coming up next, where I think we're finally going to bring one home, and when things don't kind of the first approach doesn't work, we take another angle and we look at it. And I'll give as an example there, kind of our timberlands, where we've been trying to sell those, you know, for a few years now, and you know, not wanting to just blow out them at a bottom basement price, but always kind of continuing to look at what options we have to monetize. And I think what we've tried to include in our value adjustments is our expectation that we're going to feel pricing pressure from reality as we exit these private markets. Ryan is so involved in this, and as well as Kelly and Josh. Do you have any additional comments, Ryan, on kind of your view and our view of how we've been looking at the private market monetizations?
No, I think the track we've been doing the last few years has helped kind of set in the reality that stuff's not going to clear as quickly as we had planned, you know, or expected maybe beginning of 19 or 18 when we looked at it. And then, like you said, you know, kind of always reevaluating, and sometimes they're just not a great answer. So we just got to take the best option on the table.
Yeah, and I'll just reemphasize, it's not we're not using COVID and energy as an excuse not to exit things. We're looking at them hard all the time. And Nick, there was another part of your question, I think, in terms of milestones, but you want to repeat that, please?
It's really just, you know, that you have sort of traditional institutional way of looking at returns, and then we have this additional issue of an outsized private equity portfolio that, you know, has all sorts of issues with it. And so, you know, I was just sort of asking how you kind of matrix in the goal to preserve marks or enhance marks to generate cash of this private equity portfolio that's outsized beyond what we want as policy limits relative to a, you know, common sense institutional allocation to the broader portfolio. Just how you think about it, you know, just some comments to kind of educate us, because, you know, we all know it's a really tough hand you've been dealt, and that staff has been dealt on this issue, and it's very important, and it takes up a ton of your time, and I just wanted you to sort of stream of conscious educate the board on how you think about it and what you're doing.
So I guess just to fill out, kind of finalize the comments in response to that. So we've talked about kind of our strategy of walk, don't run to the exits, but at the same time, we are looking at value opportunities that are in these assets that maybe we wish we didn't have, but let's make as much money as we can. So that could be we've made investment in Camel's in the AEW that has worked out well for us, and you know there may be some more opportunity there in the future. We've looked at kind of where we need to loan money, you know, looking at that not only as kind of as a protective basis, but on an earnings basis. So, you know, that's kind of stream of consciousness. That's all I have right now, and I'll ask any of the other, you know, Josh, Kelly, Ryan, if you have additional comments there.
Nothing for me.
Right. Thanks.
Okay. Anything else from Makita they'd like to talk through about the investment portfolio?
Yeah, I think Leo's going to talk about the private markets.
Okay.
Leo, are you there?
Leo, you want to make a comment or two on the private markets? If not, I can jump in.
Oh, sorry, I was kind of touching muted, didn't realize. But go ahead, Aaron, you're in good role.
Yeah, Nick, Kent, I don't want to belabor the point, but no significant changes from what you've seen in the past. If you can flip forward a few pages. Come on, this one right here with the bar charts. Yeah, thank you. So what I like to do is compare this to previous quarter, and not much has changed. So the blue bars, DPI, are distributions that have been paid to DPFT. The green bar is distributions paid plus current value still in the investment. And remember, these are just funds that you're still invested in. So if something was fully liquidated, it comes out of this report. But the big difference looking at this quarter's report relative to last quarter's is that green bar and private equity. So you were above one, meaning more value per dollar invested, and now you're just below one now that you've had that change to HUF, meaning for every dollar invested, the total value is now, let's say, 0 point, it's on the next page, 0.9 something. 0.92. So, you know, to echo what Ken mentioned earlier, there is no easy exit on a lot of these assets, and they're putting in significant time, but there is the sweet spot between accepting fire sale prices and or balancing that with length of time to exit at the best price possible. And there's no magic or silver bullet out there. Sometimes it's just a really slow and challenging process,
This is Michael Brown. I had a question on the dollars that are going in. Are they capital calls or are these management fees?
A combination of both, but you don't have much left in additional capital calls for these investments. So there is a page that highlights this. If you want to go to, I'll get you there, 320, please. So the unfunded commitment number on the far right, that's what you have in total outstanding across all the private market investments. And some of these are unlikely to call that, like those infrastructure funds are past their investment period. Really, a number of them are.
And, Michael, as I think in the closed session version of the Makita report, they go in detail as far as quarterly cash activity in the private market portfolio and whether they're capital calls or fees or expenses related to the investment.
All right. Thank you.
Ryan, this is Kent. I was just trying to look in my files, but I mean, our contributions have been kind of in very small, kind of on a quarterly basis, whether it's fees or capital calls. Do you have a kind of a recollection of kind of what that number was in the third quarter?
Give me 2 seconds here, and I'll pull it up. But yeah, I mean, it's for sure less than a few million in capital calls.
2020, the capital calls were $2 million.
Okay, thanks. Okay, I think if there's, you know, see if there's any more questions about private equity, see if Makita has any further comments, and then I think we'll want to move over to the next item, which is the Hearthstone.
Okay, do we want, because that's going to be partially in closed session, do we want to move, Kelly, your report up while we're still in open session, and then do that afterwards?
I think that's a great idea.
All right.
If we want to go to page, you're already there, John. Thank you. 347, that's Executive Director's Report. As always, your monthly reports from TechSpurs and CPRS are available for you. As far as open records requests go, we received 4 since the last board meeting. They were all research-type requests, nothing for members or anything like that, just research stuff. And we don't have a problem with any of the items that they are requesting, so they've been filled or will be filled before the deadline. On the COVID front, we are still working remotely, obviously. The one thing that we have changed since the last board meeting is we are using a new system to receive documents back from members. In the past, they were scanning them and emailing them to us, but since this is going on a lot longer than we thought, we are now having them upload them through a link, which is more secure. It's more time-consuming on our end, but it's more secure, so we're doing that, and the members seem to be adjusting to that as well. We have to walk them through it, but it's working. So that's the big change there. The other thing is we still have 38 people that receive a paper benefit check that we've been unable to move over to direct deposit. And in this last month, 2 people called and said that they didn't receive their check. So we're going to do another push to try to get those remaining people to take direct deposit, you know, with the whole issues with the post office as well as COVID, maybe they'll be more willing to do it. There are a few that have told us they're never going to do it and stop asking them. So we're not going to reach out to those few people, but we're going to make another push to try to get those 38, you know, as many of those 38 as possible to direct deposit. But other than that, we're just kind of business as usual. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, so now we'll go to item 14. And is there anything that we should say in open session or instead just go straight to closed session? Josh, anything?
Maybe Ryan would be the person to turn to on that, please. Ryan?
Okay.
We got a couple slides in open session that give an overview of the property and a little bit of the history, and then we'll go, 2 minutes, and we'll go into closed session. But we should have Verizon and Todd on the line. Are you guys there? John, I don't know if you need to unmute him, but I know Todd should be on. While we're doing that, this property,
hey, Ryan.
Book it in. Hey, Todd. You know if Bryce is on as well?
I'm on, Ryan. Good morning.
Okay, awesome. Well, Hearthstone has been the manager of Spring Valley and Harris Creek, located in kind of Boise area, since 2015. And I think this is the third or fourth time we've come to the board to talk to you about a possible sale, so hopefully it is the last that we're going to have to hear about it. But these guys took over from CDK in 2015 and done a good job kind of getting us through some difficult issues and closer to a sale. So I'll turn it over to Todd and Bryce to give a brief overview of the asset, and then we'll go into closed session to talk about the possible sale.
Great. Hey, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you guys today. I'm Todd Rosa, Vice President and Senior Investment Manager at Hearthstone. I'm looking at page 339 on your slide deck. In February 2015, as Ryan mentioned, we were appointed investment manager of 4 assets, Three of them were in Idaho and one in Colorado. Since that time, three of those assets have sold and closed escrow. And the remaining asset, which is the Spring Valley and Harris Creek properties, which are near Boise in Idaho, are now under contract. And we're speaking to you today seeking approval to conclude that sale. Moving to page 340, the Spring Valley asset is about 6,000 acres. It's about 30 miles northwest of downtown Boise in the city of Eagle. And then the Harris Creek property, which is depicted on page 341, is about 9,600 acres in the foothills, about 10 miles north of Boise.
Is that everything in open, Todd?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so a brief overview of the property, and then we'll transition over to closed session now.